It's Sean Rice here, and in today's training, I'm going to dig deep and personal with tons of examples on the concept of creating and coming up with a disruptive innovation in your niche. I'm going to dissect about 20 disruptive innovations in the last, say, 10 or 15 years. Most of them are going to be in the internet or digital world, and some of them are going to be well-known names that you are familiar with. And I'm going to dig into why they're disruptive, why they're not disruptive for some of them, why the pricing works the way that it does, what it's going to take to come up with the pricing that you need to be disruptive, the other four parts that need to be disruptive. So we're going to dig into today creating a disruptive innovation in your niche. You know, one of the things we've been doing lately is talking about disruptive innovation. We've talked about finding the problem. We've talked about creating the solution. We've talked about along the lines of creating an innovation or an innovative mindset. And today we're going to really get down into the nitty-gritty and give you a bunch of examples to work with. And then I'm going to give you a challenge for you to do in your niche, an exercise that you can do over the next week, and take each one of the things that need to be present for disruptive innovation and execute those things in your niche, or prepare execution, create a blueprint and a plan. I want to read you something very, very interesting. This is, I'm going to read out of the Disruption by Design by Paul Payetz. And Bruce Hoeg recommended this book, and now I recommend it to you. It's really a grassroots type of book that digs into something that I've never seen dug into in this depth. Now, Paul, in the introduction, indicates that there are four necessary and sufficient conditions that must be present for disruptive innovation to occur. Number one, an addressable market scarcity. See chapter one. Number two, a unique solution to key jobs customers need to be done that mitigates the scarcity, chapter four. When compared to possible alternatives for accomplishing the job, the price-to-value ratio is significantly lower than any other solution, often by a factor of two or more, chapter seven, execution, chapters four through ten. Now, what I think is extremely interesting, if we read this and we were to read it in the language that I've been using with you over the years, we read the first one, an addressable market scarcity. What is that? That's a need in the market. That's a need in the market. What is a unique solution to key jobs customers need to be done that mitigates the scarcity? A unique solution to the need. A unique solution to the scarcity. A unique solution to the need. So then obviously we've got to talk about price-to-value ratio, and I believe that this is one of the best ways to look at this. You know, a lot of times we talk about coming up with an innovative price. I've talked about coming up with an innovative price, innovative pricing. Paul really digs into this idea that the price-to-value ratio is significantly lower than any other solution, often by a factor of two or more, and I'm going to dig into that a little bit today. And then finally, execution. And don't we talk about execution? We can think all day long about needs in the marketplace. We can think about solutions. We can think about pricing. But until we do something about all of those things, and I would add to Paul's list, and I'm going to give you really what is my list and has been my list without realizing how close it was to Paul's list in just a moment. I'll review what that list is. But without doing these things, and then without adding on an element of getting people to know about it, whether it's through virality, whether it's through word of mouth, whether it's through the media, whether it's through buying traffic, you know, whatever it is, then nothing ever happens. So what are these four, in my words, what are these four things that have to be present for disruptive innovation? A need in the marketplace, a unique solution to the need. Now, in Paul's words, a price-to-value ratio significantly lower than any other solution, often by a factor of two or more. And then fourth, execution. And then I would add, fifth, a way to tell people about it, whether that's virality, whether that's referrals, whether that's the media, whether that's paid traffic, whether that's organic traffic, at, you know, whatever the case is. Now, we've talked about a need in the marketplace. I'm going to give you a lot of examples today. What's a need in the marketplace? A need in the marketplace is something that people need in your niche, even if they don't know that they need it, something that would simplify things in their niche or make things clear in their niche or your niche that's not being addressed today. What is a unique solution to that need? Well, if you solve the problem, that's the unique solution. So if nobody else is solving the problem and you solve the problem, then that's the unique solution. Now notice that Paul Payet says that these are sufficient and necessary. What does that mean? These are all four necessary. Meaning that if your competitor does three of these, or two of these, or one of these, and doesn't follow through on all four of them, they will not be disruptively innovative. Which means that if you see somebody else addressing a need in the marketplace, but they're doing it at too high a price, you can come in at the right price, come in with execution, and come in with a way to tell people about it, and you can be the disruptive innovator. Think about Apple. When Apple came out with the iPod, now many companies prior to Apple had come up with MP3 players. So what made the iPad so much better? Was it just because it had an Apple on it? No. It was because the iPod was so much easier to use than all of the other MP3 players. Not only was it so much easier to use, but it was presented in a very, very clever way. So instead of just being presented as an alternative to CDs, it was presented as, I think it was, 1,000 tunes in your pocket. 1,000 tunes in your pocket. It was extremely easy to use. You know, Steve Jobs and his team spent months and months and months developing and creating that little dial that would dial right to whichever song that you wanted to hear, so you didn't have to use the up button, the down button, and all of those other things. So now, if we look at that as an example of this, what do we have? We have a need in the market. We have MP3s coming out, and let's say Sony had met that need in the marketplace. So they had a unique solution to the need, but it was a basic solution. Apple quadrupled exponentially, you know, just rocket shipped the solution by making it so easy to use and to interface. And they made it so much better. But if we look at the price-to-value ratio, you could say, well, the iPod was not cheaper. But if you think about it, per song, I believe it actually was, even when it came out. So previously, let's say that MP3 players were able to hold 50 songs or 100 songs, and they weren't able to do all these other things. But I don't even remember what the prices were. Let's say it's $200. The iPod comes out, and maybe it's $400, but it's able to have 1,000 songs. Not only is it able to have 1,000 songs, it's really easy to upload them. It's really easy to download them. It's really easy to find them. It's simple. It is super, super simple. And then we have execution. Apple did a phenomenal job of execution. And then my additional fifth point is they were able to get the word out. So they were able to, obviously, because they already had a base, they were able to talk to their base. They were also able to put advertising on the air and get people to know about it. They were able to, I believe they had a few stores by then, so they were able to put it in the stores. People were talking about it. They even created a signature element to their iPod, which was the white earbuds, so that somebody that had it was clearly identified as being different than somebody that had, let's say, a Sony MP3 player. Look at what they're doing now with the iWatch. And I'll be honest with you, when they were talking about the iWatch and I saw what Samsung was doing, and they go, well, Samsung's got a watch here that syncs, same thing as Apple's going to do. It does the basic things that Apple's is going to do. I thought, you know, I think that even though Apple was first to concept, I don't think they're first to market. I was just in the Apple store a couple of days ago, and my wife put one of them on her arm. I touched and felt it. I played with it for about 3 minutes, looked at all the screens, looked at all the buttons, saw how very easy it was to use. And my goodness, this thing, not just because of its simplicity, but it's beautiful. It's beautiful. They've got a $10,000 or $15,000 gold version that I believe in today's marketplace can compete with any Rolex or Tag Heuer out there. I believe also that this watch, whether or not people use it or not, is going to become a status symbol for the middle class. You see, a Rolex or some of the other expensive watches are a status symbol for more of the higher class. And let's face it, most of the middle class doesn't purchase a full-price Rolex and wear it around. They'd rather buy a car and have, you know, leather in it, and maybe their friends don't have as nice of a car. The upper class, you might put that expensive watch on their hand. But let me ask you this. What happens in a middle-class office environment? A middle-class office environment where there's 30 people working in the office. And let's say that for Christmas, Susie gets one of these watches, maybe the $1,000 version. It's a nice watch. How many of everybody else's wives and husbands are going to hear about how Susie has an iWatch, but I don't have an iWatch? How many people, even if they say today, I don't need an iWatch, I don't want an iWatch, how many people are going to buy it, not because they want it or need it, but because someone else in their office has it? Somebody else in their PTA has it. Somebody else in their community has it. Somebody else in their Sunday school group has it. And it becomes a middle-class status symbol. Why? Obviously, there's a lot of psychology that goes into that, but it is, when we look at this list, it needs a unique solution. It meets a need in the marketplace. It's a unique solution. The price-to-value ratio, if we compare it to a Rolex, for example, is absolutely phenomenal, and especially in terms of status symbol. You know, let's face it, a Rolex for a middle-class person is probably more of a laughing thing for somebody that's truly middle-class than actually a status symbol, whereas upper-class, it might be a status symbol. But middle-class, it's probably not a status symbol so much as, oh, they think they're better than us. You know, oh, their grandfather died, and they have some money. You know, because they know that their middle-class worker can't afford that Rolex. But the iWatch can be afforded. It can be afforded. It can be put on a payment plan, and nobody has to know it's put on a payment plan. And unless you really know it, unless you really know the watch, you probably don't know whether they paid $350 for it or they paid $1,000 for it. So the price-to-value ratio for a status symbol is actually very low. That's a low-cost status symbol. And then, obviously, there's execution. So now what I want to do is get into kind of the real world. Not that that's not the real world, but I want to get into the Internet environment because that's where most of you operate. And I'm going to start with some well-known examples I've been talking about, because I want to lay the groundwork, and I want to go through these things that need to be, that are sufficient and necessary. I want to go through these things. Then I want to get into the digital realm, and I want to give you some digital companies that are doing what you could be doing in your niche. We're going to make this a transition, though. I'm going to give you five examples. Uber, Zipcar, Instagram, Rescue Time, and Dropbox. Uber. Need in the marketplace, not able to get a taxi fast enough. Unique solution to the need, an app that connects you with all the taxi drivers, all the individual drivers, et cetera, et cetera. Price-to-value ratio significantly lower. Even if the price for the Uber driver is exactly the same as a taxi driver, if you don't have to wait 2 hours at the airport, not knowing if your taxi's going to show up, then even if it's the same price, it's significantly less because your time is money. Your time may be worth $50 an hour if you wait at the airport for 2 hours. That's $100. So a $12 Uber ride is nothing compared to the $100 that you might wait. So the price-to-value ratio is phenomenal. And then obviously execution, all the points were done. Zipcar, almost exactly the same concept. Instead of having to buy a rental car for 24 hours, you can get it for an hour or two. So you may pay $30 for the 2 hours, but that's a whole lot less expensive than paying $120 for 24 when you're only going to use it for two. You might as well just pay the 30. It's a lot per hour, but the price-to-value ratio for the fact that you're going to get to use the car for the exact 2 hours that you need instead of the whole 24 and you don't even need it for 22 and you've got to get somebody else to take it back after 24 hours, or you've got to take it back and pay $120 instead of $30, there's an amazing price-to-value ratio that is significantly lower than any other solution in the marketplace. Now, I'm going to give you another one we don't always talk about as disruptively innovative, and that's Rescue Time. I personally use Rescue Time. Rescue Time, along with some other things, has changed my life. It's probably one of 20 things that's changed my life in the last couple of years, but it's one thing. And without Rescue Time, I wouldn't have made the progress that I made. Rescue Time has allowed me on a graph to know exactly what I'm doing with my 4 hours every day. I'm able to look at my 15 hours and say, boy, I wasted six of them. I could not believe I'm wasting 6 hours a day, but rescue time doesn't lie. Rescue time tells me the truth. And for me, that's disruptively innovative. It's meets a need in the marketplace. It's a unique solution to the need. The price-to-value ratio is significantly lower than any solution. There's two versions. There's a free version that gives you exactly what I've shared with you, and then there's a paid version that's actually very, very inexpensive that allows you to set times of the day or to just push a button, and it will block you from getting to any website that you have predetermined is a distracting website. So, for example, if you're distracted by the search engines, if you're distracted by social media, and you just look at your report for the last month or the last week in rescue time, and it'll tell you where your hours were spent on those kinds of things, and you go, look, I'm spending 6 hours a week on social media, and I'm not getting the productivity time in that I need to, I'm just going to tell the computer, I'm going to tell rescue time that from 10 to 2, Monday through Friday, I'm not allowed to access social media, I'm not allowed to access search engines, I'm not allowed to access video. If you need something like that for your business, you just make a note that at 2:01 you can go do it in your business, but it forces you to be highly productive from 10 to 2. For me personally, that's disruptively innovative. Here's the last one, Dropbox. Remember when Dropbox came out and there were two primary solutions for losing your stuff on your computer? One solution was to go buy a backup drive and then back up every day, which was actually pretty convenient when 90% of all devices were at home or in the office. It was a desktop computer. It was backed up every 24 hours and no big deal. But now that, I don't know what the number is, 70, 80% of devices now are laptops or tablets where the work is being done and things are being stored. It makes it a lot more difficult to update to one of those devices. There was also, I think it was called Carbonite. I think they're still around, but there was Carbonite. And Carbonite, and there was one other company, I don't remember the name of the company, but those companies were much more expensive, if I remember correctly, than Dropbox is today. Not only were they more expensive, it was not Carbonite, but I used one of the other competitors one time, and I was paying whatever it is, $30 a month or something to back everything up. And then when I had a failure and I had to download everything, I had two choices. I could either stream it all down, and it would take like 3 days and $180 or something of bandwidth to do it, or for like $80, they could FedEx me my files. Now, I'm sure it was in all the fine print when I started paying $30 a month, but I didn't realize. I thought I could just click a button. Well, enter Dropbox. With Dropbox, you just click a button, and it's there. Not only is it there, but I can access it online. So if my computer just goes away, and I don't even have to buy another computer. Before I buy another computer, I can borrow a friend's computer, go to my Dropbox account, and do any of the work that I need to do right there in Dropbox or on their computer. I can do it. It's right there. I don't have to FedEx anything. I don't have to download anything. I don't have to upload anything. And the price is amazingly cheaper than everything before. So once again, we're looking at need in the market, a unique solution to the need. Price to value ratio is significantly lower. Now, I'm going to make a bold statement here because some of you right now might be saying, well, these things have already been done. Uber, Zipcar, Instagram, Rescue Time, Dropbox, these things have already been done. I believe that there's probably five times as many things left to be done in terms of simplifying our lives with technology than have been done. And if you don't do it, somebody else will. I really believe that. If you'll keep up with the tech digests and the technology magazines for the next 2 years, you're going to see these things coming out, and they're going to keep coming out. I really believe this for the next 5 to 10 years. And these are solutions that are not difficult to implement. They're just a matter of brainstorming it for a reasonable fee. You can find somebody at freelancer.com or one of the other coding websites to create the code for you. You can put these things together. From there, it's just a matter of marketing. There's a lot of unmet needs in the marketplace in the area of simplicity. Just think about all of these. None of these invented anything. Uber did not invent taxi services. Zipcar did not invent rental cars. Instagram did not invent photo sharing. Rescue Time did not invent productivity. And Dropbox did not invent file sharing or file storage. None of them invented. All they did was they went in and made things simpler or clearer. How can you come up with a simpler or clearer solution in your marketplace. Now, I want to move over to digital markets because some of you may be thinking, well, yeah, I don't really want to get into software. I just want to sell ebooks, and I want to sell training, and I want to do videos and audio and that kind of thing. Great. I'm going to give you a bunch of examples in that realm. You may know of some of these. You may not know of some of these. You may need to do some research this week on some of these so you can fully understand what I'm sharing with you. But I want to go into some digital markets. Now, I'm going to go to kind of the big, everybody knows about it, Amazon first. And I recognize that Amazon's not something you're going to copy. Again, when I ask you to copy Uber, Zipcar, Instagram, Rescue Time, Dropbox, or any of the others either, we're asking you to come up with something in your niche that simplifies or clarifies. Look at what Amazon did. Everything Amazon does now was done perfectly fine before Amazon. In fact, many bookstore owners that have gone out of business would tell you that it used to be done better. In fact, in my opinion, I like the old way. I mean, I still buy the majority of my books from a local bookstore. Now, why do I do that? I have two reasons. Number one, I like to have the physical book. I really do. I do not like to read on a tablet. There's a few different reasons for that. I'm not going to go into them in this call, but just I'm going to tell you my personal preference is I don't like to read on a tablet. I'll tell you some of them. I work on an electronic screen for 4 to 10 hours every working day. And some days a little bit less, but they don't even count as working days if I ski all day and work for an hour or two. It's not really a working day. Working day, I'm on an electronic screen for 4 to 10 hours. I work really hard on that electronic screen. I don't take the required breaks that my eye doctor tells me I'm supposed to. I don't take the breaks my neurosurgeon should probably tell me that I should. My psychologist might tell me I need to take certain breaks. All kinds of breaks need to occur. I don't take them. I just power through. Okay. Now, is that right or wrong? It doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. The bottom line is from 4 to 10 hours, I am glued to a screen. Now, I also read somewhere between 1 to 3 hours almost every single day without fail. Do I want to look at another blue screen for 1 to 3 hours? No. I don't care. I don't care if there's blue light glasses for me. I don't care. I don't want to look at another screen. There's some other reasons for it, but we'll leave those alone. I like the physical book. Next, I really like flipping through books. I go to the bookstore, and I may flip through 40 books in an hour or two. I read a chapter in each book that seems interesting, or half a chapter, and then I come out with 3 books that I buy. Can I do that on Amazon? Yes. Is it as fun? No, it feels like work. But the bookstore feels like fun. For me, the bookstore is like a kid going to Playland. I go to the Playland. Now, if I don't buy books at the bookstore, they'll go out of business like all the other bookstores go out of business. And so my feeling is, if I want them to exist, I'm going to have to patronize the place. So that's me, personally. Amazon, if you think about it, does not do anything better than any other store out there. But what they do better is they're able to aggregate everything. So instead of having to go to the clothing store for this, the electronic store for this, and Walmart for this, and REI for this, you just go to Amazon and get everything. Instead of having to leave your house and get a little bit of exercise and have some fun and meet people, you can stay at home and wait till the UPS driver shows up in a couple of days, or maybe in a couple of years, until a drone comes by your house and drops off whatever your gift is, and it allows you to spend more time at home and less time out. So Amazon is doing a great job on all of those things. They've been highly disruptive for people that are very price conscious. They're doing a phenomenal job because you can buy things for whatever, 30, 40, 50, 60% less. You can get them in a couple of days. You don't have to drive to the store. You don't have to be inconvenienced, et cetera, et cetera. We're not asking you to reinvent Amazon in any way, shape, or form, but I wanted you to see that as kind of a grand example. I want to give you 3 more that I'm not going to dig into. These are also digital. These are probably not things that you're going to copy, but they've also been done. How about weather.com? Weren't there plenty of ways to get the weather before weather.com? I remember before weather.com, I had a business about 10 or 12 years ago where in the winter times I had to check the weather every single night to make sure some equipment wouldn't freeze or we had to turn some heaters on. So I would call in to the local number to find out what the temperature was. Well, now you just go to the weather.com app, and in, 10 seconds, you know exactly what it is. You don't have to call in. You don't have to listen for a commercial. It's just there. Click, and it's there. Totally disruptive. How about Huffington Post? This one's a little bit different because you could say, well, Huffington Post just fits into all the content or it fits into all the news. I believe it's different. I believe it's different because it's a highly curated news source that's not like an original news source. But you can get what you need at Huffington Post depending on what you need. So depending on your demographic, you can get what you need over there at Huffington Post. And she's done a phenomenal Arianna Huffington has did a phenomenal job of putting that together, even while there were tons of other bona fide news companies like the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, that are trying to go digital. She was able to do something and then sell it for a great price and then stay on as the editor of a great company in something that was truly disruptively innovative. Even though everything had already been done, she was able to bring it together in a way that nobody else had done. There's one more. This probably shouldn't be on the list. It's kind of right there with Rescue Time, but I'm going to put it in here anyway because I think that for us it's relevant. And that's Lifehack. You know, we've gone through this whole thing with all the article directories and then easing articles. And, of course, then when Google got so tough, easing articles had to change a lot of things. They still lost some traffic. They still lost some credibility. You know, they're still out there. They're still cranking. They're still working. And one of the things that a lot of us thought in the marketplace was that article directories might just kind of go down the drain. And under that name, for all practical purposes, they did. But isn't Lifehack just a glorified article directory? And yet, they've done a great job of positioning it to a very unique market where people are able and willing to be able to read on there and to share on there and for things to go viral on there, even if you aren't established. I remember when I first started on easing articles, I probably had to write 100 articles before I got to like 2,500 visitors to the articles. And I had to write a bunch of articles. When I wrote my first article to Lifehack, now, I'll be honest with you, I seeded it by sending the article to everybody on my list and, hey, take a look. If you like it, share it. Now, is that any different from you being able to do that with Facebook or G+ or wherever else you hang out online? You've got 100 friends. You can send it out just like I did to my list. But I got about, 400, 500 visits to that article. Virally, that went from 400 or 500 to 2,200, 2,200 in the matter of a few days. Lifehack is just one of many websites that have done basically the same thing. So this is a disruptive innovation in the niche area of content marketing. And that's why I'm giving it to you. Because it's easy to look at some of these other examples and say, well, I can't do it. It's already been done. But with this, we all saw the demise of article directories going down, and we all could have postured a solution for it similar to Lifehack right now. Now, if we look into the future, I'm not going to tell you what they are. I think that's out of place on this call. If we look into the future, we see where search is going. We see where organic marketing is going. We see where low-cost traffic is going. What can we do to disruptively innovate in that marketplace? Now, I want to move on now. Before I move on, I'm going to give you two more. One's an example of crowdsourcing. I believe that almost every niche in the world has the availability of a crowdsourcing type of thing. Your niche could probably use a crowdsourced solution. And if you take a look at freelancer.com, you can do what Freelancer has done in the arena of matching buyers and sellers of online projects with each other. In your marketplace, you can create a crowdsourced solution for buyers and sellers. I believe that almost every niche out there could use something like that that's done at a high level. Now, I say almost because there's going to be some small pockets where, you know, there really isn't much of a need. And you have to use the judgment on doing that or consult with some folks that have the judgment and the experience if you don't have it. 99 Designs does something very, very similar. I believe there's an amazing amount of opportunity for crowdsourcing. And if you really want to dig into crowdsourcing on a wide scale basis, read the book Bold by Peter Diamandis and Stephen Kotler. The book Bold. And there's an entire section on outsource or crowdsourcing, and it's a phenomenal, phenomenal read. Now, I want to get into the digital arena. Because you may say, well, I'm in the digital arena. And I'm going to give you two examples of disruptive innovation that have occurred in the last 3 years. These are in huge markets. These are in markets that both of these markets, it could be said it could never be done. But I'll tell you who they are, and then I'll talk about them. Ryan Dice, digital marketer. Ryan Dice, digital marketer. Now, the concept there is aggregating internet marketing training all under one roof. Okay, now granted, has digital marketer gone as big as those folks would like for it to go, as they predicted that it'll go, that it may go in 10 years? No, it hasn't. In fact, I would even say that there is room in the market for a viable competitor, meaning that you're going to have to do things 2 to 5 times better than Ryan's doing it in order to kind of blast him off a first mover. Is it possible? I don't know. I believe, though, that there is a room for that. I believe there's a place for that. If you look at what Russell Brunson has done in the dot-com secrets world, that I believe it's even a smaller scale, and some of you might look at that and say that doesn't even qualify, and that's okay, but I want you to understand that both of them have done what most people would say could not be done. Think about the big-time gurus. Think about folks like Glenn Livingston, Dan Kennedy, Perry Marshall, others, myself included in the past, where we have really preached a message of divide and conquer. Go into a small pond and come up with a high-priced solution. And we've often talked about this idea that what Digital Marketer and dot-com secrets have done is not possible, meaning that if you try to do something, you'll just drive the price down to zero and it won't work. And maybe at some time in the future it will. I mean, that would probably be the long-run prediction in that arena, but there may be 5 to 10 years before that occurs. They've gone in and they've done something that many of us said could not be done and probably would have advised against doing, and yet they did it. I want to give you another example. This is an unusual example, and I remember a year or two ago when Ryan Levesque really started talking about sales funnels. And I'll be honest with you, I was impartial to this. I was partial to this because I have always had a very difficult time selling sales funnel training. And it breaks my heart because people will buy training that's all about traffic when they don't need traffic. What they need is, know what the need is, a unique solution, a price to value, an execution. And in the traffic, if they just work on virality and they work on referrals and they work on talking to everybody they know and they work on organic things, the traffic happens naturally. And then if you want to layer on paid traffic, great. But folks want to go the opposite route, start with traffic, and try to build the whole thing with traffic. And people are 20 times more likely to buy a traffic topic than they are to buy a sales funnel topic. And it breaks my heart. And I look at that and I say, please, I beg you, get my sales funnel training. It's great. It's the greatest in the market, maybe I might say, if I'm having an arrogant moment. I really believe in it. It's great. And yet, the folks kind of turn their nose up and go, I don't really need that. What I really need is more traffic. What they really need is a sales funnel. And so I had really been struggling with the issue of sales funnels, trying to make a niche out of it, and failing miserably. And for those of you who might look at me and say, you know, boy, all we see is the successes. Do you fail? Of course I fail. I failed at coming up with sales funnel niche. And when Ryan Levesque initially came out with, along with a couple other folks, some sales funnel training, I just thought, my goodness, talk about falling flat on his face. It's not going to work. I mean, a couple of his cronies might push it to his list, and they might make a few sales, and they might buy themselves a little vacation out of this, but they're not building a niche out of it. But when I see what Ryan Levesque has done in the last couple of years with some amazing clients that have gone to kind of direct media buys online and leveraging millions of dollars worth of traffic on a monthly basis and doing millions of dollars in profits and net profits and that kind of thing with these sales funnels that he's created, and then he gets people to buy them at high prices. I look at that and I say, you know what? That's disruptive innovation. Now, he's doing something that the need was in the market, but me and a whole bunch of other people were unable to find a way to plug the market. Seriously, me and a whole bunch of other people were not able to find a way to plug the market, and yet he came in and created a unique angle to the sales funnel training, not because it was a superior sales funnel. I'm not saying it was not, but it did not sell because it was superior. It sold because he had like a superior way of talking about it. And so people were attracted to this concept. And, of course, once he got some clients and once he got some deep pocket clients that were spending, say, $1 million a month on traffic, he was able to get some huge results, and then he was able to use the results to brag. And so there's some things that go in there. And then when you look at what he's doing right now, the price-to-value ratio, it's significantly lower than any other solution. A couple of years ago, I think that he was selling his training for $10,000 or so. Six months ago, he was selling the training for $300 to $500. And now you can go to the local bookstore or Amazon and buy the book that has all the formulas in it. I don't want to say all the formulas, but has the formulas in it for $20. So totally disruptive. A few days ago, he was number one overall in Amazon. We're not talking number one in self-improvement, number one in internet marketing, number one in business. His book was number one in the world on Amazon, and 3 years ago, he was practically a nobody that went into a niche that me and many others have tried with loyal clients just like you, begging you to take that training course. You that are listening to the sound of my voice right now, you've probably all bought my sales funnel training because you're ahead of the crowd. You're the folks that are taking action. But 99% of the folks on my list, no matter how much they like, love, and trust, and respect me, they would not take action. Ryan Levesque is able to come out of the dark. He's able to come up from the ashes like a phoenix. He's able to come in, do something nobody else thought was possible, charge $10,000 for it, then charge the masses $300 to $500 for it. Now, literally 2 or 3 weeks, go number one in the entire world for his book, starting from scratch just a few years ago. I called it disruptively innovative. Now, we're going to look at your market in just a moment. But before we look at your market, I want to look at two people in the marketplace that are not doing disruptively innovative things. They are right on the cusp of it. They're both on the cusp of it. And in fact, if you were to talk with them, they might even tell you that they're being disruptively innovative. And if I were talking with them personally right now, we might get into an argument over it. And in fact, both of these people would look at me and say, Sean, we're 100 times more successful than you. Therefore, we have the right to tell you that you're wrong. So I'm willing to stand up and be wrong right now. I'm going to give you the names. You're probably even going to think that I'm wrong. Dan Kennedy and Perry Marshall. Dan Kennedy and Perry Marshall. Now, they both respond to needs in the marketplace. Dan Kennedy, in his heyday, came up with unique solutions to the need. Perry Marshall, in the AdWords world, where he kind of got his claim to fame, he came up with unique solutions to the need. When he partnered up with Richard Koch a couple of years ago in putting together some of the 80-20 ideas, Richard Koch had come up with a unique solution in the 80-20 world, but Perry took it kind of to the next level and really applied it to the business world and to the data-centric world that we're running into. But it hasn't gone viral because it's missing, in my opinion, it's missing the price-to-value ratio that's significantly lower than any other solution. Because although Perry Marshall is the only person in the marketplace that's really doing what he's doing, Richard Koch still really gets the original credit for the 80-20 business applications for it. And because pricing is still so high, Perry Marshall's not has not been able to take the 80-20 work that he's been doing to the digital marketer level, or the Ryan Levesque Ask Book level, or the RussellBrunson.com Secrets level. Not because it's not a phenomenal concept. In fact, I mentioned to you earlier that rescue time was probably one of 20 things that has changed my life in the last 15 months. Perry Marshall's dissection of 80-20 and the application that I've put into my life and my business is another one of those 20 things. I don't know if it's 20 things. It could be 15 things. It could be 25 things, whatever the case is. But I give amazing credit to Perry Marshall for making that happen. I have an amazing amount of respect for Perry Marshall. I'm a member of Perry Marshall's mastermind and gladly pay every single month because of some of the insights that I receive there. I've learned an amazing amount from Dan Kennedy. But if you think about it, both of them are serving as a guru in the marketplace at higher prices, but because they're missing that price to value thing, then they're not able to go disruptively innovative like Ryan Levesque has done in 3 years, going from a nobody to number one world bestseller on Amazon in a few years, teaching I don't know how much business his clients have generated. You could probably find the number somewhere, 100 million, 300 million, et cetera, et cetera. You see, those are special people, and they command higher prices. But let's face it, are you a Dan Kennedy or a Perry Marshall? Now, if you are, if you believe that you have everything in you that Dan Kennedy and Perry Marshall and Tony Robbins and Stephen Covey have inside of them, then go for it. But if you want to be more like the guy that started Amazon, if you want to be more like the woman that started Huffington Post, if you want to be more like the guy that started Facebook, if you want to be more like the guy that started Uber, and instead of having to be an ultra guru at really high prices, you just come out with something phenomenal at a low price, I submit to you that it will be easier to learn how to scale your business if you're doing something really simple than if you try to start today and become a Dan Kennedy or a Perry Marshall or a Tony Robbins or a Stephen Covey. Now, let's look at your market, your marketplace. I've given you tons of examples. Now I want to relate it to you because, you know, you may be thinking, well, hopefully you've seen these examples and you're thinking, yeah, I can do one of those things. Or maybe this is illumination for what you've learned earlier. This is illumination for what you've learned from me earlier on this topic. But now I want to tie it to your niche. I'm actually going to use 5 sample niches. Now, let's first of all look at the 4 things that have to be present. A need, a solution, price-to-value ratio, execution, and remember, I'm adding a 5th to Paul's list. And that is, you got to tell the world about it. Virality, referral marketing, get the attention of the media, pay for traffic, or organic spreading content marketing, that kind of thing. All 5 of those things, I believe, have to be in place. Think about your niche. You know what your niche is. You got it in your mind. I'm going to give you 5 niches that I believe one of these is probably kind of similar to your niche. Meaning that I'm not going to give you crocheting, but if you are in crocheting, you're related to one of these niches. I'm not going to give you the internet marketing niche, but if you're in the internet marketing niche, you're related. I already told you that I believe that there's room for innovative disruption in the internet marketing niche. Ryan Dice is trying to do it, and I think he's doing a great job, but I think there's a worldwide level to go, and I believe that you could possibly be that person. Now, does that mean it's going to be the easiest one to do? No, it's probably the hardest. You know, it's probably something outside of the internet marketing niche is going to be the easiest thing to do, but I believe that it's there. I believe that that the internet marketing niche is ripe for an innovation, is ripe for an innovation. And I'll even let you in on something. I'm working on innovation right now in the internet marketing niche. Now, will I be first to market? I don't know. I'm working on 3 or 4 other things as well, and out of the 3 or 4, one of them should go big. Will the internet marketing one be the one that goes big? Who knows? Who knows? Just wanting to be completely transparent with you. You folks are in my highest level training. I want to be completely transparent with you. I'm doing something different on these recent trainings than it's something I've ever done before. Usually I wait until I've done it. It's tried, tested, true, proven. Then I teach it to you. Well, by then you're a year behind. I'm giving it to you before I do it now. I'm giving it to you as I study it, as I learn it. I'm giving it to you. So if you want to, you can do things right alongside with me. Five niches: gardening, real estate, weight loss, muscle and fitness, personal development. Now, we've talked about two things that are innovative disruption. One, software like crowdsourcing, groups, Facebook, that type of thing. And then we've talked about information, selling information. I'm going to give you two examples for all five of these niches. But before I do this, I want you to please agree with me that one of these niches is sort of like yours. Because when I give you these solutions and then you say, well, I'm in scrapbooking, it doesn't matter because you didn't tell me about scrapbooking. I guarantee if it works in gardening, it'll work for scrapbooking, it'll work for crochet, it'll work for karate, it'll work for underwater basket weaving, as long as there's more than three people in the world that are interested, it'll work for online education, it'll work for making rocket science accessible to the average human, it will work for, any information niche out there it'll work for. I'm going to give you five examples. Gardening. What if in the gardening world there is a crowdsourced website that allows gardeners of all ages and types in all climates to be able to meet together and have small groups, something similar to the social networking environment on Facebook, but it would just be for gardeners. It would be the number one gardening crowdsourcing type of thing in the entire world. And if there's anything like it right now, it's not big enough and it's priced too high. Imagine if you were to come in, you were to create something that every gardener in the whole world wanted to be a part of, and you were able to seed it by finding 1,000 gardening experts and inviting them to be experts on your brand new site. The only thing they had to do was be willing to submit one tip a month in exchange for hundreds or maybe thousands of visits from the people that are going to be coming to your website. Could you do that in the gardening niche? I believe that you could. I believe you could do it in crocheting, in scrapbooking, in karate, in swimming, in skiing, in snowboarding, in every information niche out there. I really believe that you could do that. Now, you could also do that with training, gardening training. There's some great gardening websites out there. Do any of them truly offer a complete solution for every climate, every plant, every tree, every price point? I don't believe so. Now, would that be an incredible undertaking? Absolutely. Is it the type of thing that could disruptively innovate in the next 5 years? I believe so. Now, remember, I just pulled gardening out of a hat. It's just the first thing that came into my mind. But this can be done in skiing, in snowboarding, in karate, in swimming, in crocheting, in karate, in self-defense, in prepare for the end of the world, in weapons, in overcome political groups that you don't like, every information topic out there, you know, that formula I just gave you will work in. I'm going to give you four more. I'm not going to spell it all out because I just did. Real estate, same thing. Imagine if there were one website in the entire world that aggregated all listings in the entire world that are on all networks in the entire world, and not only did it do that, but it also allowed you to buy and sell homes for $1,000 a piece, and it did all of the paperwork for you. You look at companies like Zen Payroll, and you look at companies that do your accounting for you, and you look at companies that do your merchant processing for you and do your affiliate processing for you. The same thing could be done in real estate. I mean, you could literally have an online closing where everything was signed online, and then you'd, whatever the laws are in your state, you'd still probably have to sit down with a notary and spend 5 minutes and have some things stamped. But seriously, imagine if you could create in the real estate world a website that did all of those things, and it would totally banish the commission requirement. Obviously, some areas may have a commission legality or something along those lines, but imagine if you were to do something that was so popular that sometimes people would choose to buy in areas where they could buy on your website as opposed to having to buy somewhere where they paid a 3% commission on a $1 million home. Think about that. Now, if you think about that for the real estate market, could that not occur for every other market out there? If you think about it, cars.com is basically doing that for the car market. But what are some other markets? What are some other markets for higher priced items? How about specialty trucks? How about those big shovel trucks? What if you had a dedicated, not just a website, but a full network that handled all the exchange? You'd literally make a payment on the website, and your website would serve as an escrow handler, and the money would be released when the truck showed up where it was supposed to show up. Absolutely, it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing what you'd be able to do. Go to the Alibaba website in America. I think it's Alibaba.com. Of course, we know Alibaba is the Chinese version of kind of Amazon and Google, I guess, all of that put together. I don't know how it works. But if you go to the American version of it, you'll find that you can get hooked up with manufacturers in China that they'll make you like 1,000 T-shirts for $2 a piece, and they'll ship them over in a container. You can buy sweaters. I mean, you could start a whole store by shopping directly with China. Now, you know, the big companies, what do? They fly to China. You know, they talk to the factories themselves. They make the agreements. But if you go to Alibaba, you could probably do all of it virtually. Now, I'm not suggesting that you do that. I'm suggesting that as an example. They are serving as an exchange market for the people in China that have the factories that speak Chinese and the people in America who want to buy the cheap goods from China that speak English, and they're able to serve as a buyer's exchange between the two and have ratings and everything, just like Freelancer. You know, you go to Freelancer and you say, Freelancer, I'm only going to hire somebody if they've done at least 100 projects, and on average they have 4 out of 5 stars. That's my criteria. Now, you may be better off hiring somebody that has never done anything before because they might work harder for you. That's beside the point. But let's just say you only want to work with companies that have had 100 transactions, 4 or 5 stars or better. Well, with Alibaba, maybe you go in and say, I'm only gonna buy sweaters for my store from factories that have at least 100 transactions and some testimonials and at least 4 out of 5 stars. So there's practically a guarantee that you're going to get what you paid for. Could you not do that in your niche? Let's name a few others. The weight loss niche. Now look, the weight loss niche is huge. They have to laugh. Every season, every January, I go into Barnes & Noble or Tattered Cover, and what's the big counter in the front of the store? There's like 25 different books on all the different diets. There's the Atkins diet. There's the Paleo diet. There's the Eat Watermelon diet. There's the Eat Cantaloupe diet. There's the Alkaline diet. There's the Green Leafy diet. There's the All Chicken diet. There's the All Meat diet. There's the All Celery diet. There's the Balanced diet. There's the Get Slim diet. There's the Get Healthy diet. There's the Omega-3 diet. There's all of these diets. Now, if you pick up all the books and read them, it's very interesting, but like 90% of all of the information is exactly the same, with the exception of whatever thing they're telling you to eat. But even if they tell you to eat cantaloupes 3 times a day for 21 days, after the 21st day, what do they tell you to do? Eat a balanced diet. How do you keep the weight off? Eat a balanced diet. What are all the recipes? Balanced diet recipes. What if you were to come into the weight loss industry and say, you know what, I'm not going to create another weight loss training program. I'm not going to create a new website that's going to sell paleo or Atkins or whatever, low carb, high carb, low fat, high fat, low protein, high protein, starve yourself, gorge yourself, you know, whatever. I'm not going to come out with a new weight loss thing. What I am going to do is I'm going to come out with a revolutionary new system that absolutely makes every weight loss diet in the entire world obsolete by simply saying, look, instead of following all the diets, instead of following one of the diets, instead of following none of the diets, let's get your psychology right, find the exact diet that is right for your temperament, try it out for 2 weeks. If it works, great. If it doesn't work, switch to another one instead of falling off the bandwagon. If it does work for 2 weeks and third week it doesn't work anymore, take a week off and switch to another diet. Or, guess what? Just go to the 21-day diet and just eat totally natural and normal instead of any of these diets. And then what if you were to layer on social groups with accountability? And then what if you were to layer on some coaching exchange where people would coach you for a reasonable fee for losing your weight? You'd pay a reasonable fee to have weekly accountability. They'd get paid a reasonable fee to let you tell them what your weight is every single week for 5 minutes. What if you were to create a totally world-changing weight loss site right now? What would happen to the weight loss industry? Two more, muscle and fitness. I don't have to go into the details on this. You can do exactly the same thing as I've talked about for real estate, gardening, or weight loss for muscle and fitness. I mean, there's dozens and dozens and dozens of programs out there and pills and potions and all kinds of things to bulk up and get strong. What if you were to put it all in one place? All in one place. Now, obviously, there's one big website out there. I think it's called, and I'll remember it because it's right, you know, after I get off the call, I'll remember it. That's how it happens sometimes. There is a big muscle and fitness website that actually got very, very popular a few years ago. And it's, you know, it's primarily forums and training programs and reviews, et cetera, et cetera. What if you were to go study that website, take everything I have just given you, and say, I'm going to take their concept and I'm going to make it 100 times better. I'm going to make it 100 times better. I believe that you could. I mean, seriously, I think that you could do that. It's bodybuilding.com. So bodybuilding.com. What about personal development? What about personal development? There's so much room in personal development. Now, if you look at personal development market, you might say, well, I can't compete with Tony Robbins and Stephen Covey. You think about it. They're just kind of comparable to Dan Kennedy and Perry Marshall. They're the high-paid gurus of their market space. But couldn't you become the low-paid guru that doesn't even have to be a guru, but is really able to max out in your marketplace and in your market space and do the kind of things that we've talked about? I've given you tons of examples. Could you not do the same thing in the personal development world and have like everything under one roof with an incredible price-to-value ratio, with groups, with accountability, with coaching, everything under one roof? Now, remember, there's that fifth thing that's not listed in Paul's list, and that is you're going to have to go with have virality, referrals, word of mouth, paid traffic, organic traffic, get the media involved, et cetera, to be able to go big like that. But if you are absolutely determined, like Steve Jobs was, like Jeff Bezos was, like Mark Zuckerberg was, you're absolutely determined to go big, you can do it. You can do it. That's the only thing stopping you from going big. You've got to have these five things in place. You've got to have a need, a solution, a price-to-value ratio significantly lower than any other solution, often by a factor of two or more. You're going to have execution, and you're going to have to tell people about it. And if you're absolutely committed to doing that, no matter what it takes to do it, I believe that you can do it. And so now what I'm going to do is I'm going to leave you with homework. And the homework is take your niche, take what we've talked about today, determine what the need is, determine what a solution is, determine how you could make it price to value, determine what your execution plan is, and think about how you can integrate things like virality, referral marketing, media, et cetera, organic content, blogs, videos, et cetera, what could you do to scale and go big? What could you do in your market space that mimics anything that we've talked about today? And folks, I believe that if you do that, you'd be absolutely amazed at the type of results that you're going to be able to get. And then I have to warn you, once you've got this list, you're going to have to execute. Because if you don't execute, somebody else will. Because while you're doing this in your niche, somebody else may be too. And within 5 years, your niche may have the solution in it, and you have a choice. You can be first to market, or you can write the blueprint and then sit on it and think, that it can't be done. But it can be done because you can find a way. Like John Sculley says in Moonshot, there has to be a way. And people like Steve Jobs and Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg, yeah, they're special people. But the truth of the matter is they put their pants on the same way you and I do. They, you know, they eat just like you and I do. They have the same kind of psychological problems that you and I do. But guess what? They're absolutely committed to finding a way. Are you absolutely committed to finding a way? And if you are, I believe that you can innovate in your market space.